Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
You are listening to the Mother of All Talk Shows podcast with George Galloway.
And this is London, but coming to you, of course, all over the world, thanks to the wonders of the internet, will deal predominantly with America. And the reason for that is that America is exploding like a supernova. A supernova explodes and the planet that's exploding, the star, tears itself literally apart, turns itself literally inside out. And from here, that's what America looks like to me. It is approaching anarchy on the streets of the United States of America. And the anarchy is not stopping short of murdering people with firearms on the streets. A Trump supporter last night was murdered, and the murderers rejoiced. They rejoiced that we got a Trumper, we got a fascist. And I'll come back to the question of nomenclature in a moment. This followed, of course, a Trump fanatic, 17-year-old vigilante, who killed two people and shot and wounded a third just a night before. This follows police caught on camera shooting a man seven times in the back in front of his family as he got into his car. No discernible threat to the officers involved. Even Donald Trump says he didn't like how it looked when he watched the footage. This is the proximate cause, of course, of still more rioting. I won't call it protesting, because there comes a point where you can no longer say that this is a protest when buildings and motor cars are on fire, people are being assaulted and intimidated. That becomes a riot. And as I think you know, I don't approve of riots. They go up like a rocket, but they come down like a burnt stick. And they have very often the precise opposite of the effect that people imagined they might. And I warned you about this right at the beginning of the Black Lives Matter affair in the United States. I said that if this was not handled carefully, Donald Trump would be the main winner from it. And that's already happening. Michael Moore, the great filmmaker, warning the Democratic Party in the last 24 hours that Donald Trump is catching up fast in the opinion polls, and in some swing states, particularly the state of Michigan, where Michael Moore hails from, Trump has moved ahead. And it's not hard to see why, is it? If you were an American Joe, if you were mom and pop watching the television as your country literally tore itself apart, would you be terribly enthused to be out voting for Joe Biden in those circumstances, a man who can no longer tie his shoelaces, no longer remember even where he is or what he is? Michael Moore says that 60 million people are incredibly energized to vote for Donald Trump. For Joe Biden, not so much, says Michael Moore, a master of understatement. And then there's the news that my friend, Governor Jesse Ventura, is, after all, entering the race. And he, the best of all of the candidates standing, will take some stopping, particularly in certain parts of the United States. And the economic situation almost has to be seen to be believed. I'll be speaking to two prominent American commentators shortly. But to summarize, the economic situation in the United States is on the brink of being entirely comparable to the Great Depression that followed the crash on Wall Street in 1929. We're talking tens of millions of unemployed. We're talking millions of people facing imminent, now imminent, eviction from their homes with no possibility whatsoever of paying the rent that they had been relieved from paying as the stimulus package, $1,200, runs out. No more money, no ability to pay your rent, no preclusion on evictions. We're going to have millions of people in America with nowhere to live, nowhere to work, and no money to eat in a country with hundreds of millions of guns in the midst of a polarization politically between the right and the right, with the people being offered no meaningful plan out of this almost complete disaster. That's how America looks. Now, I want to turn to this issue of political nomenclature. You see, Donald Trump is not a fascist. If he was a fascist, there would be no elections. There would be no courts. Nobody would be allowed to demonstrate. Nobody would be allowed to exercise any civil liberties, any lawful rights at all. Trump is an oftentimes dangerous right-wing populist, to be sure, but he is not a fascist. And when you shoot one of his supporters and say you've killed a fascist, you have gone down a very dangerous road. And that's happening in America. You've all seen, I'm sure, the videos of mobs of people, overwhelmingly white people. If you want my honest opinion, overwhelmingly white middle-class people, mobbing in restaurants and cafes, forcing diners on pain of who knows what to raise their fists in the BLM slogan, the BLM fist, and to utter the BLM slogans. And you'll all have seen, as I have, pictures of people refusing to do it because most people, and I am one of them, do not like mob rule. This actually has more akin to fascism than the supporters of Donald Trump do. That's my view. It's not fascism, but it's closer to fascism than the people that are routinely accused of fascism. Why do I feel sore particularly about this point? Because this week I've had to get used to the fact that me, am far right. The Trotskyites say that I'm far right. The soft shoe shufflers of the Remain camp say that I'm far right. And now the Scottish nationalists say that I am far right. Me, taught by Michael McGahey, the miners' champion, and the late and great Tony Benn, who sat at their feet and learned everything that I know. I'm now far right. Why? I'll tell you why. Because although I'm the one that was carried off by the police and thrown in Greenock jail for opposing nuclear weapons, because I, despite the fact that I am the man, lifelong member of the Transport and General Workers Union and the National Union of Mine Workers, me, the anti-war leader, me, the champion of national liberation struggles against colonialism and imperialism all over the world, I am far right. I'll tell you why. Why am I far right? Because I don't believe that a man becomes a woman merely by self-identifying as such. I'm called a homophobe because I don't want my children to be taught at school about anal sex. Despite my Stonewall Award, I'm a transphobe. I'm a homophobe. Because I supported leaving the European Union, I'm a nativist. I'm a British nationalist. Because I believe in my own country, I'm called a racist. I'm called far right. This, ladies and gentlemen, and I insist on that dichotomy, is the road to madness. You cannot go on calling everyone to the right of you a racist, a fascist, far right. Not if you want to persuade anyone. You can't go on evincing your hatred for your own country and your own countrymen and women. I insist too on that dichotomy, and expect your own countrymen and women to give you their political support, to give you their votes, which you need in a democracy. This tendency on the so-called left has to stop now, before the left disappears up its own fundament. Because you don't want that statue pulled down, you're not far right. Because you won't agree to abandon pronouns, you are not far right. Because you're demonstrating in Trafalgar Square against masks, you are not far right. You might be bonkers, but you're not necessarily far right. And because a fascist stood at the back and hung a fascist flag over the wall, that doesn't mean 30,000 people in the square were fascists. I could have hung a hammer and sickle over the same wall. That wouldn't have made the 30,000 people communists. Do you feel me? This tendency. And before I leave Trafalgar Square, I will never forget the sight of Piers Corbyn chanting freedom, freedom, standing behind an outrageously well-fed David Icke. But that doesn't mean they are fascists, that they are far right. They're just people with a different point of view to you. So what's left nowadays? If you support the European Union, a bastion of neoliberal capitalist economics, a European fortress to keep out the rest of the world in trade and in free movement, that doesn't make you left. If that's left, I'm not. If you support so-called humanitarian interventions all over the world by NATO, that's not left. If that's left, I'm not. Because you want to tear down the Albert Hall because you don't like the tunes that they normally play and can't just switch over to watch something else instead, that's not left. If that's left, I'm not. Do you get me? This is where I am right now. I demand that we properly name things, that ontology is important, that identifying, misidentifying political opinions is the road to perdition, and maybe even civil war. And we may well be on the brink of civil war in America. Another one. We'll be talking to someone else from New York, too, about specifically New York issues. Caleb is my go-to on the American political scenes. He is my colleague at RT, but he's also a writer and a political activist and a power on social media. Follow him if you're not already. Caleb, welcome back to the show. These are very grim times. Just lay my cards on the table. While I want to see the end of the American empire, because I want to see the end of all empires, I don't want to see your country tearing itself apart. I don't want to see blood running down your streets But as I look at things today, that's what I'm now fearing. Where do you stand?
Indeed. We just had another shooting last night. A Trump supporter was shot in the streets of Portland. And that comes on the aftermath of just a few nights ago in Kenosha, Wisconsin, as people gathered to protest yet another police murder. Then a young person, someone under the age of 18, showed up and opened fire, killed two of the anti-police brutality protesters, shot others. So this is a situation that has many worried about the future of the country. People are comparing it to possibly the years of lead in Italy, where we saw far right wing and far left wing groups in the streets killing each other, shooting each other. And what's interesting about that period in Italian history was we now know about Operation Gladio and how the CIA was involved in that. And it seems like we're in a situation where it's not just the population here in the United States that is polarized, but it's the government apparatus itself. There's a big call from the Democrats now to defund the local police, defund the cops. The local police, not surprisingly, are much more supportive of Donald Trump. Meanwhile, many within the intelligence apparatus, intelligence officials and such, are rallying behind Joe Biden, wanting to defeat Donald Trump because they think Donald Trump is a threat to the U.S. foreign policy apparatus and status quo. And it seems like not only is the population divided, but the state apparatus, the military, the policing agencies, the intelligence apparatus is also divided. The United States is polarizing very quickly.
It is uncharted. These are uncharted waters. A man of your age has not seen anything like this in the United States. A man of my age, even, has never seen anything like this. There have been riots before, of course. There have been substantial riots. I remember in the 1960s in Watts, for example, very, very substantial riots. But this is all across the country. It transcends color, though color is a significant part of it. Many of the, I suppose we could call them left-wing rioters, certainly anti-Trump rioters, are not black. In fact, to me, it looks, in the pictures I see, disproportionately white. The apparatus being split, the political class being split, these are all quite unprecedented factors for me. And it's very hard to see where it ends. It seems to be accelerating, Caleb.
Indeed. And probably the biggest factor driving it forward is economic. Unemployment is through the roof. People are losing their homes. Evictions are rising. This pandemic has just decimated the U.S. economy. It has just destroyed it. Trump was boasting just a few months ago about how the United States had the greatest economy in all of its history ever. Well, that all came crashing down very, very, very quickly. And now many people are scrambling to pay their bills. Here in New York City, outside of the office of the Catholic Charities in Queens, there are big lines almost every day of working class people who are worried about how they're going to eat and feed their kids, and they are suffering. And I think that this unemployment, this problem spawned by the pandemic, spawned by some of our deeper problems in U.S. society, like the elimination of good paying industrial jobs, like the rise of what I would call a low wage police state, all of this has culminated in an economic crisis that is leading to instability on the streets. The country is politically polarized. People are not seeing eye to eye. And the two major parties seem to be at odds about how to resolve it. We just had the major conventions. Democrats emphasize that they are fighting to preserve the status quo, that Donald Trump is a radical and he's making everything crazy and inciting Americans against each other. They're going to make things the good old America. Like the way they used to be before Trump's radicalism. Donald Trump, on the other hand, just had a very, very successful convention that gave him a little bit of a boost in the polls because he said he's fighting for the quote-unquote silent majority. He pulled a card from Richard Nixon and basically is arguing that that he's the law and order candidate. He's going to bring stability. He's fighting for average Americans who are left out and ignored against these elites that want violence and chaos in the streets. It seems like right-wing populism from Donald Trump Trump and a defense of the status quo that is very, very strong and loud from the Biden camp. That's the choice Americans are going to have in November, neither of which really address the underlying economic problem.
Michael Moore said that the 60 million Trumpers are a frenzied pitch of readiness. The supporters of Joe, not so much. That seemed to me a shrewd observation, and perhaps like a cloud no bigger than a man's hand could be a harbinger of something big to come.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why United Healthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Well, Michael Moore called it in 2016. All the polls in 2016 seemed to indicate that Donald Trump would lose and Hillary Clinton would be victorious. But Michael Moore, ahead of the election, he said, look, he said the white working class that have been left behind economically, that are angry at Hillary Clinton and the Democratic Party status quo are going to turn out in big numbers. He referred to Michigan, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, and Ohio as the quote-unquote Brexit states, and he predicted Trump's victory. And he was right. And people didn't see that in the polls. And right now, sure, the polls look pretty good for Joe Biden. But Trump is but Michael Moore is predicting a similar turnout, a similar situation. The thing is, in the Biden camp, you just don't have enthusiasm. People just don't get excited about Joe Biden. His speech closing out his convention was very much a conciliatory speech. People were actually reminded of the malaise speech of the late Jimmy Carter and his remarks about how during the economic crisis, he was going to bring everyone together. He cared. It's a conciliatory tone. It's kind of a pessimistic, dark tone. It's not exactly the tone that gets people fired up and excited. The United States is a country very much associated with optimism and hope and the American dream and going out and working hard. And Donald Trump has tapped into that American enthusiasm. Whereas the tone coming from the Democratic Party is let's calm down, let's stabilize things, let's listen to both sides, let's negotiate. And in a time when people are suffering and upset, it seems like that angry tone coming from the Republicans might win out.
The swing state polls have narrowed quite considerably. And in one of them, Michigan, as it happens, the latest one has Trump ahead for the first time since this crisis enveloped your country. It's obvious to me, it was obvious before it got underway, that widespread unrest in the country, law-breaking, looting and so on, was going to help Trump and harm the Democrats. But the Democrats are incapable of bringing that under control, aren't they? Because these people, whatever definition you would give them, they're not hanging on Joe Biden's every word.
Indeed, there is a rank and file of the Democratic Party, people that were supportive of Bernie Sanders, people that are angry about issues like lack of health care, people who are upset about police brutality and systemic racism, that are out in the streets. And probably one of the primary reasons that they are filling the streets right now is they don't really have an electoral expression. There's really no way to vote for what they want at the polls. Joe Biden is very much associated with lock him up, tough on crime bills, and so is Kamala Harris, his running mate. Kamala Harris was a prosecutor in California. She rose up the ranks in California's prosecutorial apparatus at a time when the prison population was rising and rising and rising. She is associated with trying her hardest to keep people on death row, locking people up for smoking marijuana, and then she jokes about the fact that she herself is also a pot smoker. People on the Democratic camp don't feel excited about their candidate, and many of them are feeling like the only way they can express themselves and give voice to their agenda is to be in the streets. And that seems to be driving a lot of the anger behind the protests. Meanwhile, Donald Trump, like I said, pulling a page from Richard Nixon and trying to say he's going to calm things down. He's going to be tough on the commies and the radicals that are in the streets breaking things. He's the strong man fighting for middle America against the chaos and the extremism of the far left. Donald Trump is running against Joe Biden as if Joe Biden is a communist. He's calling him a Trojan horse for the far left, when everyone knows that Joe Biden and Kamala Harris are about as centrist and mild as you can get. And the rank and file of the Democratic Party knows that. And a lot of them just don't have enthusiasm for their campaign.
Never was there a time more designed almost for a Bobby Kennedy or for an early Bernie Sanders. But that just fell away, didn't it? There was no chance in the primary season for such a candidate to emerge.
Indeed, the Democratic Party, which is the party of urban political machines, you can go back to the Chicago machine, the Philadelphia machine, the Tammany Hall machine here in New York City. The Democratic Party is very much a party associated with urban political machines and corruption. And in the Democratic Party, people wait their turn. Now, it's not who gets the support of the rank and file. It's not who's the best and most charismatic politician. It's who has, you know, waited out and waited their turn in the pecking order of the Democratic Party. The Democratic Party is associated with a lot of the corruption of bureaucracy in urban centers of the United States. And because of that, it's not really able to give the average person who would vote for the Democratic Party what they really want. Meanwhile, the Republicans are a party of fanatics. They're a party of right-wing fanatics, religious fanatics, militarist hawks, and others. However, people believe them when they talk. The passion that they have is genuine. They believe what they're saying. Many people may not agree with them, but people take them more at their word. And this is the weird contradiction of politics in our time. But we should be very, very concerned because gun sales in the United States have risen by 72%. And we're seeing these shootings, these political shootings, people killing each other at political rallies. I mean, the country is destabilizing very, very quickly. And whoever wins the election in November is going to have the task of trying to bring the United States back to stability and back to civil order, because the country is destabilizing and spinning out of control very, very quickly.
Now, the new third party, People's Party, I think it's called, forming up this weekend. Have you had a chance to run your eye over that?
Well, that's a lot of Bernie Sanders supporters who had planned to have an alternative convention to the Democratic convention. They plan to have a people's convention. Now, with the pandemic, we're not really having conventions. And so, but yes, the movement for a people's party has been in the works. Many voices of people that were prominent in the Bernie Sanders movement are pushing that. And it's very likely that if Joe Biden is not victorious in November, that these two viewpoints within the Democratic Party will part ways. So there's one viewpoint that wants to go in a more social democratic Bernie Sanders direction. There's another wing that wants to go in a more mainstream direction and maybe even team up with the neocons that are backing Joe Biden right now, such as John Bolton and others, such as George W. Bush, who's also backing Biden. There are two ways forward for the Democratic Party. And it seems that if Joe Biden is not victorious, it's very likely that the Democratic Party will part ways, that there will be a division. But let's be real. There's also a deep division within the Trump camp and the Republican camp as well. There's a lot of neocons in the Trump camp who are very unhappy with the Steve Bannon element and with the populism of the Trump movement. We saw Rand Paul, who gave a speech at the Republican convention hailing Trump as a non-interventionist. Meanwhile, we had Mike Pompeo, the Secretary of State, violating the norms of U.S. politics, speaking from Jerusalem to address the Republican National Convention and hailing Trump as going after Iran and going after China. There are deep divisions within the Republican camp as well. It seems that from the right and from the left, Americans are tired of the status quo. The status quo being, you know, unregulated free market policies, you know, the deregulation of the economy, globalism, military interventions around the world. A lot of people in the United States are just unhappy with this status quo, where the United States seems to be run by global multinational corporations. Now, from the right, that translates into economic nationalism. From the left, that translates into democratic socialism. But in both camps, there is distrust and unsatisfaction with the way the United States is moving.
A tour de force, as always, Caleb Maupin. Thanks for joining us here on the Mother of All Talk Shows. Much appreciated. Now, the poll's going, almost 1,000 have voted in just 20 minutes or so. Do you believe wearing masks helps prevent COVID-19? Yes, 55%. No, 36%. C, it's a conspiracy, 9%. 932 votes in so far. You can vote on my Twitter feed at George Galloway. Those of you of a certain age will remember the magic moment at the Nelson Mandela concert at Wembley to mark his 70th birthday, which I had some small part in creating, when Tracy Chapman appeared on the stage. We'd never seen or heard of her before, but she made an impact that reverberates still. I felt the same when I interviewed my next guest just the other day on Sputnik, which went out yesterday. You can catch it on YouTube now. She's Kayla Popoche. She is a Pulitzer Center Fellow, and she's the Queen's Borough Coordinator in the Queen's County Civil Court. I wanted to talk to her, as I do again now, about the situation in New York City, which has been devastated by the coronavirus, devastated again by the economic crisis, and which has now a rocketing level of eviction notices being given to people who cannot imaginably pay the rent that they've built up over these months of the coronavirus. I hope she's on the line now. Kayla, very nice to talk to you again. For the benefit of those who haven't yet seen your Sputnik interview, tell us, sketch, if you will, the situation for the working class and the poor in the great metropolis of New York.
Hi, George. Thank you for having me once again. I hope I'm coming in clear.
Yeah.
So for those who don't know, I know there's this idea of New York City as, you know, the capital of capitalism. It is the great, you know, as you said, metropolis, beautiful city. Millions of people want to come here. It generates billions of dollars every year. And to tell you the conditions of the working and the poor in New York City, it would seem like there are two different cities, because that's exactly what there is. And we call it the inner city, right? The conditions that working class people are facing right now in New York is unfathomable, and it's disgusting for such a city with so much capability. The working class is 19% of people are out of work. Millions cannot pay for rent in New York City. Thousands are getting petition papers set for eviction for not paying their rent or having some type of disputes with their landlord during the pandemic. And the government hasn't done much about this. You mentioned the eviction cases, the eviction moratorium a little bit earlier, and that's coming. It's also very partial, but it's dwindling. So landlords can still start cases against their tenants. And now these tenants who don't have money, who haven't been able to pay for food, who haven't been able to make their payments on electricity or gas, are now also having to worry about keeping their home. And they're forced into such precarious situations while we are still dealing with the pandemic.
And unemployment at 19% in a city as big as New York means a gigantic number of people literally on the street most of the day, looking for work, looking for a way of feeding their families at home. And of course, if these evictions really take off, if nothing is done, they'll be living on the street with their children.
Exactly. That is definitely something that millions of people are worried about in New York City. There have been protests against the opening of housing court. There have been protests demanding that the city cancel the rent and take the money that is given to NYPD, which is billions, take that money and instead paying people's rent. What the city has done in exchange for that is saying tenants can now apply, more tenants than before, can apply to this loan program. So basically, tenants can take a loan from the government to pay back their landlord, and now they're in debt to the government, which is a catch-22 for millions of these people that are forced into these situations. There are millions of people without work. There are undocumented people that don't have work and also aren't accounted for, who don't get any assistance, who don't qualify for any governmental programs, and are just forced into suffering and into even more precarious, unsafe working conditions, doing whatever that they can. Another thing is that these shelters are also over capacity, and so now you're seeing even more people laying in the streets, sleeping in the subways, and doing whatever they can. They say that violence is rising in New York City, which is partially true, but that's because there's been so many austerity cuts to our social programs that instead are going to the police. The police are now being used as a catch-all for all the social ills. If you're homeless and you're sleeping on the train, you call the police. If there's a dispute with your landlord, you call the police. Everything is calling the police, and there's no money going to the services that actually are supposed to directly help our communities.
And the picture you paint is apocalyptic enough. So for those of us who remember New York in the 1970s, when things were extremely bad, the city was bankrupt. The political leadership in the city spends most of its time fighting with the political leadership in Albany, doesn't it? Even though they're both notionally in the Democratic Party.
Right. And, you know, they're both to blame for the conditions that we face. Don't get me wrong. New York City is a beautiful city. This is the city that I've called my home my entire life. The people in the community is vibrant. But we have these politicians that have left us to suffer the scraps of their failures. You have our Mayor de Blasio, who is actually taking a lot of the blame for the problems in the city. He is hated both by the left and the right and the center. And he's kind of put himself in that predicament while he also fights with the governor, who is supported by the center and the right. He is supported by big business, real estate. A lot of his funding comes from real estate. So while they fight with each other, we're the ones that are facing the you know, detriments towards that.
Now, I think it would be fair to say your politics are to the left of theirs. How are people that think like you faring in this vortex? Are you finding an audience for alternative politics?
I will say that's one thing. While the state does target people who think, you know, leftists, they let the right wing run amok. As you saw a couple years ago, the Proud Boys were able to harass, stalk, and beat people up. Right wing organizations exist just fine in New York City. The NYPD has endorsed Donald Trump. So the right wing is pretty fine doing its own thing while the left is being targeted by the state. However, at that same time, more working class people in New York City are becoming aware and understanding. And I mean working class people, the people that are actually facing evictions, that are facing future homelessness, facing hunger, facing, you know, tightening of their financial capabilities. I'm not talking about the people who own their own homes and are working from home and are fine. No, that is a different type of, you know, class of people. The people who are actually facing these ills, which are a great part of New York City, are waking up and are understanding that the Democrats don't really support us, and the federal government that's right-wing also don't support us. So what is the answer? And the left is trying to mobilize and organize people more. You know, with the rise of the protests, the 2020 riots, and also the housing court movement, you're seeing different faces of people that you never thought you would have seen at the court. You're seeing young white students with old black leaders and, you know, undocumented migrants still coming out and marching despite it all. So the precarious situations that the government has forced us to live in are also getting people riled up and you know, lighting their fire and taking to the streets and doing what they can. And it's kind of exacerbated more of like a class consciousness that never really, we always kind of slept it under the rug in New York City because we live in the center of capital. We were able to do that, whereas we don't have that privilege anymore to do that. We have to become honest and we have to face the reality of what we're seeing and what's going to happen to us.
This tale of two cities that you describe, of course, Wall Street. I used to do a show, actually, from Wall Street. It was a tiny little attic in Wall Street, but I can say I worked on Wall Street as a radio presenter, is contrasted with these, for example, these undocumented workers that you were talking about. I guess the people working in the kitchens of the cafes and the restaurants, people doing the jobs that other people don't want to, they are undocumented. They didn't get the paltry $1,200 so-called stimulus, and they cannot apply for a loan to pay their rent. What's going to happen to them?
Yeah, those people are going to be in extremely dire conditions. They're likely, if they have any families at all, to move in with them to, again, even overcrowd. So that was the first problem with the coronavirus and why it was able to take flight in New York City was because the rent is so high and people don't make enough money that you have to force, like in an apartment of two, you'd have six people living there. Many people are forced to live with each other just so that they can be able to afford the rent. So that's what's going to happen more with these people that are undocumented. Either that or maybe some private charities, but there's really not a lot of resources going for them. And I hate to say it, but a lot of them are going to become homeless and evicted. And a lot of people that are documented are also going to become homeless or evicted.
And this is, as you say or imply, the reason why New York has been so badly hit by the coronavirus, because of overcrowding, because of millions in poverty. It's clear enough now that that's the perfect breeding ground for the virus.
I want to make it clear, though, that while this is a really big city, there's a lot of people. We definitely, if there was a lot of economic restructuring, it would totally be possible for people to not overcrowd and to still have the pandemic and you know, be able to confine that. But it is the exacerbation of the poverty. It is the allowing for developers and real estate and landlords to do whatever they want, to charge whatever prices that they want. They destabilized 1 million rent-regulated apartments, which allows landlords to increase the rent to whatever that they want, which is not feasible for many people. So that is the core problem. It is totally possible in New York City for everyone to live a comfortable and comfortable home, have their own home with their family and not have to live with strangers that they don't know just to make ends meet. It is possible, but it would take our politicians to doing something that they don't want to do. Like, that's why Cuomo wouldn't increase the taxes for the rich during this time, instead cutting back on our social programs.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Are you hoping Joe Biden will fix things?
I know Joe Biden won't fix things, and I know Donald Trump won't fix things. We have to stop looking to these politicians that are funded by people that profit off of our poverty. We have to start looking towards each other, and it's only the working class that has to, form together and unite and bring the government to listen to us instead of the other way around. But at this time, Joe Biden, Donald Trump, neither of them have our best interests. They're different. In the same ways, though, they have the interests of big business and the wealthy, just different sectors of it. And neither of that includes us working people.
Kayla Papuchet, thanks very much for joining us on the Mother of All Talk Shows. Thank you. Do you believe wearing masks helps prevent the virus? Yes, 54%, down one. No, 37%, up one. It's a conspiracy, 9%. 1,102 have voted so far The poll closes at 10 minutes to 9. So get voting on my Twitter feed. But we've got plenty of top guests still to come. And they don't get any better than Sonia Poulton, a broadcaster, a writer, and an activist. And she joins me now. Sonia, welcome back on the Mother of All Talk Shows. Some will think it strange that an English woman will talk with great authority on the Epstein case. But of course, one of your many campaigning themes has been the sexual exploitation of children, which seems to be everywhere in politics, in public life, in private life, in homes. It seems like an epidemic to me. And I'm guessing that was the foundation, if you like, of your interest in the Epstein case. Have I got that right so far?
Spot on.
Now,
absolutely, yeah.
Epstein is, of course, I think we can say, the most high-profile, or at the center of the most high-profile web of abusers has been unmasked so far. And his co-conspirator, collaborator, and alleged rapist herself, Ghislaine Maxwell, is still alive and facing the justice system. So what can you tell us about where we are on the Epstein-Maxwell story at this point?
Okay, well, obviously, Ghislaine Maxwell is in the same correctional facility, Metropolitan Detention Center, New York, as Jeffrey Epstein died in. And what was interesting, George, is that even though she's banged up, she's still getting preferential treatment. We hear this weekend that Maxwell is the first person to get a visit from a lawyer after this COVID period is through. So that just shows you that even when she's in prison, she's still subject to preferential treatment. And you're absolutely right. The reason that I took an interest in Epstein and Maxwell in the first place is because I was primarily interested in paedophiles within the British establishment. But the fact is that Epstein's operation, as you so correctly said, was an international operation. And wherever I turned, I couldn't ignore him. He was just constantly there, always tied up with somebody that I was investigating on this side of the pond. So obviously, Maxwell, we're waiting to hear what's going to happen. She's, you know, waiting her trial for sex trafficking, faces up to 35 years. I would be highly surprised if she even got to trial. Don't forget, she's still got great friends in the media. She's being portrayed to a certain degree now as a victim of Epstein, as if she was some sort of wronged woman, as if she was manipulated by him as well as everybody else. And of course, I don't know the truth, and these are all allegations. She is waiting trial. But the fact is, there is substantial information to suggest that they were partners in crime. And obviously, what we've seen recently, we've seen the files which have come out to do with Virginia Giuffre's 2015 defamation lawsuit. And that was very enlightening as well, not least because of the information that was redacted, which made me and others think, oh, this is part of another cover-up again. But there was a contradiction. And one of the most glaring things that stood out about those files, for example, was this contradiction that Maxwell was insistent that the last time she'd had any dealings at all with Epstein was at least a decade ago. And then, of course, in these files, there was an email or emails between Epstein and Maxwell in which he was telling her, act as if you've done nothing wrong because you haven't, hold your head high, walk out in the street, and all this sort of stuff. And so, obviously, that was only 5 years ago, not the decade ago, that Maxwell wanted us to believe. And so, you know, it is quite interesting. The other new development I think is interesting is that the Attorney General now is seeking information on Epstein's relationship between Epstein and Leon Black. Leon Black being one of the most powerful men on Wall Street, a multi billionaire, along with Leslie Wexner of Victoria's Secret. And the question for many people is, why were these incredibly powerful billionaires constantly giving money to Jeffrey Epstein? And I think that is something that the Attorney General is quite keen to unpack regarding Leon Black.
Yes, for sure. His whole rise and rise to billionaire status is inexplicable in normal terms. This is a man with no qualifications, who was a failed school teacher, was not an economist, not a banker, and that he ended up right at the center of this web of billionaires is not explicable, except as a part of his filthy, obscene obsessions with children.
Absolutely. I mean, that is the reality. Maria Farmer, lest we forget, who was the first person to come forward and actually give information regarding the criminal charges against Epstein, she said quite clearly that Epstein took orders from Leslie Wexner. Now, certainly Wexner gave a terrific amount of money, including paying millions into a company that Epstein set up in 2013. So lots of people were giving this man money, apparently for tax advice. Well, that's interesting again. Multi-million pounds for tax advice. I mean, I know that accountants can be well off, George, but this is quite a whole other story, really, isn't it? Yeah. And obviously, what we're hearing repeatedly over and over again, the allegations are that some of these powerful men, I'm not making allegations against any of the men I've named, but some of the very, very powerful men who were around Maxwell and Epstein, they were being sent to have sex with, well, these young girls were being sent to have sex with them. And so, absolutely, there is every reason to believe that what we're dealing with is this filthy, corrupt operation that probably involved blackmail. We know there were certainly links to the secret services. You know, there was so much going on. We know how secret services get involved in blackmail to do with child trafficking. There's a lot to unpack here. My biggest worry, George, is that everybody is so focused on the names, such as Prince Andrew, for example. And what I would hate to see happen is all the other big names manage to somehow just slip away very, very quietly. Don't forget that, for example, in Epstein's Black Book, you had some of the most major American political players, the Trump family, the Kennedys, the Clintons. All of these should be subject to examination, what their relationship entailed, why they were so often on Epstein's Island. I think there's so much more to unpack on this story.
Yeah, sure. I mean, you can be in someone's book. Your phone number can be in someone's book, entirely innocently, of course. But it's hard to see what the reason for repeated visits to Epstein's Island could possibly be. You know that old joke that was asked by Mrs. Merton of Debbie McGee? What did you first see in the multimillionaire Paul Daniels? I'd like to ask Lord Mandelson, Tony Blair, Ehud Barak, and so on.
Right.
What did you first see in the multimillionaire Jeffrey Epstein? Why was he so attractive to you that
why was he so engaging?
Yes.
Yeah, absolutely. And let us not forget, recently, Judge Esther Salas has lost her family. Judge Esther Salas being the judge that who was put in charge of the lawsuit to delve into the affairs between Epstein and Deutsche Bank. Suddenly, somebody claimed to be from FedEx rolled up at her door and killed her husband and son. And that was literally, not even a week after she'd been given that case. Apparently supposed to be somebody who was an anti-feminist who had a problem with her being a female judge. I don't buy that for a second. You know, it's absolutely ridiculous. We are dealing with multi layers of corruption of very, very powerful people. And you're absolutely right. Just because somebody has somebody's telephone number, it doesn't mean that that person is corrupt at all. But you're absolutely right. And that is these people who had repeat trips on the Lolita Express over to Epstein's Island. They can't possibly convince us that they didn't suspect something if they weren't even involved. So I think it is a stinking affair. We need to get to the bottom of it. I think it would be a crying shame if Maxwell doesn't face justice, because there is a great deal of worry about that. I can see it already being implied. I can see the propaganda happening in the media. You know how it works, George. And as I say, she comes from not only a crime family, but a media family. And so that family is very, very well entwined with the media establishment. And I think that there is a degree of protection around her at this moment in time. And that we need to be very, very concerned about.
By the way, the killer of the judge's husband and son was himself then found dead, either by his own hand or somebody else's hand. A kind of Jack Ruby affair. This gets murkier and murkier. I'm glad you and others are still looking at it closely. Do come back, Sonia,
and tell us
when there's more to report. Sonia Poulton,
thanks so much.
Thanks for joining us on the Mother of All Talk Shows. poll two is out. If you could vote in the US election, who would you vote for? A, Biden, B, Trump, C, Jesse Ventura. You can vote now on my Twitter feed at George Galloway. This should be a good one. It will be interesting to see what our audience thinks about that poll. So you've got until just before 10 o'clock. Biden, Trump, Jesse Ventura. Now, the coronavirus is still with us, always with us, maybe always, always will be with us. The man who's been with us right from the beginning is, for me, the oracle on this and other medical issues. He's Dr. Ranjit Brar. He's the Moats medic, and I welcome him back to the show. Thank you, Doctor. Let me start with yesterday's demonstration. I don't know how many. They said 35. That's a bit of an exaggeration, but there were certainly tens of thousands of people in Trafalgar Square yesterday. They seem to have a fairly incoherent membership, from David Icke to the new British Union of the party of, in the memory of Oswald Mosley, the British fascist leader. But many people in between, many ordinary working people, many, you might call them libertarian people, not at all fascist, indeed probably think they are fighting against fascism. What did you think of the makeup of that demonstration, its demands, and where this story goes?
Thanks, George. Pleasure to be back with you. Yeah, so I watched the coverage of the demonstration and read a few articles about it with interest. They were certainly an eclectic group politically, as you say, from the far right to, well, perhaps, the, as you say, the libertarian wing. The masks are muzzles, as far as I can see, is a slogan championed by Peter Hitchens in his voluminous output on social and mainstream media. And, you know, there is a considerable minority body of opinion, very active on social media, that we've known about and have discussed many times over the last few months, George, who are, well, skeptical that coronavirus is a genuine entity. And they're for a variety of reasons. The concept of fake news has been with us particularly since Donald Trump, but the awareness that the mainstream media and the political class in our country and the US do not have the interests of the vast majority at heart has become an increasingly widely held opinion. And then when it comes to a public health emergency, such as we are genuinely facing, I think there are large numbers of people who see the agendas which are being pushed, and we've discussed those, whether it's privatization, whether it's increasing number of private contracts that are given out, even over test and trace, very lucrative contracts that were just given over the last couple of weeks to some of the major marketing firms, the big four accountancy firms, and so on and so forth. So there's a constantly accelerating agenda, and the emergency legislation around COVID pushed a variety of issues, including total deregulation of building and planning, for example, things which clearly, you know, our ruling class, the Tory government as it stands, have been wanting to push and saw an opportunity to push. So there is a job to do of disentangling all the many streams of quite nefarious sometimes policy and political activity that go behind the scenes. And this is a good time to bury bad news, a good time to bury policies which could be otherwise very unpopular, just as, for example, Theresa May sought to push forward her reforms to pension as she thought she was going to easily win a massive majority over Corbyn. So in the face of a corona pandemic, which is real and is causing real disruption to the lives of millions, coinciding with a huge economic crisis, which is affecting the lives of really workers throughout the world, and probably we're looking at towards 10% unemployment by official figures, and 20% downturn in the UK economy. So massive impact, a huge, you know, people have been talking this week about, for example, the massive rise in youth unemployment, which is becoming evident. So there are huge social problems which are being faced. Of course, the daily headlines are about coronavirus and the two issues of people's lives, deteriorating living standards, economic problems, are conflated with the health problems. And there's a wide, you know, spread degree of frustration with the problems that workers in our country are facing. And very often that points in the direction of people's, you know, mistrust of the official narrative. Of course, confusion in that narrative doesn't help. And then the alternative agenda, which seems to lie behind it. But, you know, in terms of the demands, you know, which essentially are to get rid of masks, to get rid of social distancing, to ignore the coronavirus as if it's something that isn't real, it shows fundamentally a kind of disconnect from reality. It's, you know, people across the political spectrum, across the world who are facing this problem, their responses have been very different. And there's no question that right now the reaction of different governments are holding up a mirror to the makeup of our society and to the makeup of the economic order of our world and to the fact that this economic crisis is worsening the conditions of, you know, hundreds of millions and billions of people across the world. But the answer to all those problems is not to deny the existence of coronavirus, which is quite clearly a genuine phenomenon, George.
We still get people insisting that it is no worse than the flu. I read out from someone earlier a missive which challenged both you and I on, and indeed what she described as the left on this coronavirus issue, who continue to insist that deaths from the coronavirus, deaths in general this year, are no more than they would be in a normal year. This is manifestly, statistically, nonsense. Yet a huge number of people continue to say it. What is the truth about the death rate in Britain from coronavirus?
You know, this is a phenomenon that I've seen since the very inception of the pandemic. My initial response was looking at the raw numbers, the numbers of people, when it was a major news item, when the outbreak was happening seemingly only in China, though we've subsequently realized it wasn't just happening in China, but it was recognized, diagnosed, characterized first in China. That information was very rapidly shared with the world. But there were, you know, my initial reaction was to say these are relatively small numbers compared to other phenomena we're seeing. But we have seen how desperately infectious coronavirus is, many more times than normal bacterial infections, many more times than other viral infections. So that left to itself, without a change in our behavior, we saw that the average R rate was between 3 and 4, and some countries reaching 6 or 7, others slightly less, so depending on the social characteristics, how closely people were, living, cohabiting, how closely people were in terms of city or countryside, and the characteristics of, you know, different nations and economies. But the basic fact of the matter was the virus was incredibly infectious. Now, that's fine. If it's just the common cold, doesn't matter that it's infectious. And generally, the world is not set up to stop the spread of viruses, precisely because the general rule is the airborne respiratory type viruses have not been desperately high in mortality. The flu is probably the highest, and it's generally considered the best policy to allow it to spread, to protect those who are most vulnerable with a vaccine, which we do have, mitigate its effects in that way. This is fundamentally different. Whilst the flu, you know, yes, it affects people who are elderly and have comorbidities, and probably talking about 0.1% mortality or less globally, though a very large number of people get it, and particularly the elderly, coronavirus we saw was fundamentally different. People have been worried about pandemics for many years. Some people look back and say that anyone involved with planning for epidemic scenarios are involved in some kind of a conspiracy to cause harm or to spread social change by panic mongering, and now this is them rolling out their plan. But the reality is we've seen several coronaviruses, SARS, MERS in particular, that have had this desperately high mortality precisely because they cause a viral pneumonia, which is not characteristic of the common cold and is not characteristic of flu. And it's that viral pneumonia, as well as a kind of vasculitis type problem, which we saw with coronavirus, which led us to believe that its true mortality is between 1 and 2%. Well, now that's significantly higher. And if it's so infectious, and although 1 and 2% seems low, if you're talking about an everyday problem and someone says it's 1% risk, I frequently perform operations for patients and I say, look, the risk of mortality of not making it through this operation within 30 days is 1%. And this seems a low level of risk that we can live with. But that's, of course, one individual. If you're exposing an entire population, a worldwide population potentially, to 1 to 2% mortality, you're talking about, you know, 100, 150 million potential deaths. And this is not to panic monger, but these are the very real problems that the world is facing. Now, the Chinese, who dealt with this problem very effectively and very efficiently, as did others, including in New Zealand, including in Korea, including in Vietnam, including in even sections of India, whilst other sections running rampant, they adopted widespread public health measures to prevent the spread. And having done so, have been able to return to a relatively normal life. And it seems self-evident that to mobilize the nation's resources, health resources, economic resources, to allow the threat to be of this infectious pandemic to be curtailed in an organized and efficient manner is the quickest way of getting over it and getting back to life. And really the consistent criticism, in particular the United States and the United Kingdom, actually precisely because of our economic model, though economically powerful countries, though wealthy countries with a huge economic disparity between rich and poor and a lack of access to the poor in the United States to healthcare measures, to testing. In the first instance, we were seeing patients unable to pay for testing when they wanted it, and the resultant spread that we've seen in the United States. And in the United Kingdom, it was a deliberate policy choice that we were going to adopt this strategy of herd immunity, which, as we've seen, in an immunologically naive population who didn't have previous exposure to a virus which was far more deadly than the flu and has been very consistently shown to be so. I know that's still disputed by the people who doubt the existence of coronavirus, but it has been. And on a world scale, if you look at the tested cases, and again, we've had another 2 million cases this week. So that means, you know, more than a quarter of a million people worldwide we know by testing are contracting it each week. Every day on a world scale, at least 6,000 people are currently dying of coronavirus. So while the deaths seem to have gone down in the UK, and there's a lot of arguing as to why that is, whether it truly is a less angry virus, whether it's mutated to be less angry, or in fact, whether despite the fact that cases have gone up, it's probably at the moment the relatively younger parts of the population who we know suffer fewer ill effects due to the virus. That means there are fewer deaths. But of course, if the virus becomes more prevalent in the population, it becomes increasingly hard for the elderly and vulnerable and sick to isolate themselves, and in which case, yes, the death rate can go up. But there's unquestionably the case, George, I'm sorry to go on, but it's unquestionably the case that, you know, if you look at excess mortality in that early part of the year, 2 to 3 months, we saw in the region of 70 to 80,000 deaths.
Extra deaths.
And that's very hard data, which can't be argued away. And, you know, the only real factor in a year which was otherwise looking like initially that we had fewer than expected deaths on a downward trend of mortality, you know, the new factor is the coronavirus. And those two phenomena so clearly coincide, it's very hard to simply dismiss it out of hand as if it was not a real phenomenon.
70,000 people with families. So that's hundreds of thousands of people have had their lives badly affected or lost in just a few months in a developed, wealthy country like Britain. If you read the Telegraph today, I don't know if you yet have, it is a devastating indictment on the Boris Johnson government and its handling of this crisis. There is no doubt that the United States and Britain have fared worst in the whole world because of policy and administrative failures in our two countries, don't you think?
I think that's undoubtedly true, and I think it's an indictment of the essentially laissez-faire economic approach and the laissez which was applied in the field of health, because this was the manner in which, you know, the big wigs, the leading figures of both governments think and, you know, quite deliberately promote. And that has, you know, similarly devastating economic effects.
I wanted to ask you about that, Doctor. Of course, it could be just a coincidence that two blonde-haired free market champions are presiding over the two countries that have fared worst, according to the Daily Telegraph, not according to me. But the truth is, isn't it, that though the proximate cause of this economic collapse is the coronavirus, it was a collapse that was waiting to happen. This crash was already in the pipeline before we ever heard the word coronavirus.
I mean, that's absolutely the case, George. So, you know, there's much talk about the free market. I think in reality that the market has not been free in the sense of small producers freely exchanging with each other the goods that they produce on a small scale. That has not been a characteristic feature of the world market for well over 100 years. Before the First World War, and what we see overwhelmingly in our market today is, in fact, the domination of monopoly, the domination of a very few players who control the overwhelming majority of production. And the problem with that is they've impoverished such a vast, massive humanity to such a degree that they, in fact, cannot buy the very goods which can be produced in ever greater abundance, ever cheaper unit price. But despite the relative cheapening of the unit price, the decrease in human labor power necessary to produce all these goods, the impoverishment of the working people, who are bound to be the ultimate market, the recipients for the goods of industry, are so impoverished they can't buy them. And so goods are stacked up, as they were in the 2008 crisis when it was blamed on a housing collapse. But what did that housing collapse mean? It meant really, as Professor Wolf has so eloquently said in your show in the past, and I've seen him, it was an expansion of credit. So when the people are impoverished, banks found a way they could loan their capital, loan money to people who could never afford to repay the loans, which was artificially seeming to cause a boom until it became apparently, you know, clear to everyone that those loans would never be repaid. Credit collapsed, led to the credit crunch and the collapse in 2008. And they get loads of goods, loads of very, very many manufacturing enterprises were mothballed, never to return. And there was an increase in monopolization as the very biggest players brought out the relatively big, no small players left in the market, and a further centralization. So again, we've got this absurd situation where half of the poorest half of the planet's population, so 3.5 billion to 4 billion people, have less wealth than the richest 6 billionaires on the planet. And no matter how cheaply those 6 billionaires produce, as long as their sole motivation for production is profit, they can't sell to that poorest half of the population. So it totally distorts the running of the economy. And of course, with the prospect of so many of these supply chains, short-term supply chains, having to go on hold in the coronavirus pandemic, it precipitated, and the decrease in demand associated with lockdown, which was having to be implemented in countries who hadn't put in place timely public health measures, precisely because they had so many impoverished population. And I'm afraid to say that the so-called third world, the people in Africa, Asia, Latin America, will be particularly hard hit. And the numbers, I'm afraid, will show that over time, despite the fact they have warmer climates, their relative poverty, their inaccess to healthcare facilities, on top of the, you know, already desperately poor health statistics that they are having to struggle with due to their impoverishment in this world economic system, mean they will suffer particularly badly, and that those figures will come out in time, George. But it's unquestionably the case that the massive economic downturn is precipitated by a laissez-faire system which encourages, aids and abets this kind of robbery of the world. And I'm afraid to say that system is buttressed by neocolonial wars. Anytime a country tries to buck that trend, and indeed this kind of cold war that we're seeing ramping up with China is very much a product of that. The American century, the Monroe Doctrine, you know, there's been well over 100 years of policy of the United States to ensure that they're essentially the only global player able to dominate the world's markets, and the military as well as industry work hand in glove to ensure that's the case. And I'm afraid that is the ultimate cause of so much discontent. And not a virus which, you know, human means, the current technology we have, even without waiting for any vaccination, which will help us in the current situation, we have the means to deal with the coronavirus. And I think the Independent Sage Group have been very reasonable in putting forward, the demand that our government pursue measures which would essentially, through public health measures, eradicate coronavirus as a source of disease country.
The Independent Sage Group have done very well. I've been following their stuff recently. Dr. Ranjit Brar, Moats Medic, thanks very much indeed for joining us once more on the Mother of All Talk Shows. Richard is in Manchester. Go ahead, Richard.
Hello, George. Congratulations on your new child.
Thank you so much.
And I'd just like to say, please, I had a smashing bet and won quite a few bob on Tyson Fury.
Well done, Tyson. Well done, you.
I'm on a winner. Now, my next quest is to win a few quid, and I mean a few quid, because Trump will win the next election.
He might, yeah, he might. I personally feel he will, but that's only a feeling. You know, I predicted it correctly last time. And it's my feeling right at this moment that Trump will win again.
I'm saving up a bit of money to go to the bookies.
Well, I won a lot of money in that election.
Absolutely, and
I also I won it on Brexit. I won it on the Scottish referendum. I'm on the big decisions. I've been right, and I'm not yet saying. I'm not calling it for Trump in any way, but at this moment, I would say it's curving in his direction for Trump.
I'm with you on that, George. Can I just say that I think that this lot that's going on is a redressing of too many years of Clinton triangular politics. Blair copied him, and that crooked family, along with Obamaism, it's brought American politics to its knees, George.
Well, you'll remember my phrase, Richard, as a regular listener. I'm not happy that Trump is the president.
No.
But I'm not happy that Trump is the president, but I'm very happy that Hillary Clinton isn't.
I'm sure. And I saw you when you were in the Senate, and I congratulated you on the way that you ripped them apart.
Thank you.
I'm sure at the end of the day, there were some bad, bad politicians involved in that.
There was. But, you know, I think the Democrats have thrown it away again, Richard. If they'd put up a better candidate than Clinton, and if they'd put up a better candidate than Biden, they would have won.
I'm sure. But Pelosi and Schumer, they've got to clear the swamp. It's like our Prime Minister here. He's had to clear the swamp. And along with, I'm a socialist like you, but I voted this time to get us away from Mrs. May and that cabal that she got that kept us for 3.5 years waiting to get through the Brexit.
The Brexit.
It was an absolute disgrace. And what I've learned since then, George, is probably not for me to tell you now, but it was a disgrace what happened to this country. And you were in the midst of it, as were people like Mike Graham and Talk Radio and a few other people. And they kept their feet to the fire, and we won. But they're still fighting, George.
Oh, sure. There's a rear guard action going on all the time. Even when we're out, we'll still have a fifth column trying to get us back in. Richard, enjoy your winnings, my friend. I appreciate your kind words very much. Biden's down now on 47. Trump still on 20. Jesse still on 33. 1,526 votes. Now, this is a really distressing message from Norma Cleaves. A bit upset tonight, George. You said you do not want your children being taught about anal sex. Boys need to have the freedom to choose a partner of the same sex, to be accepted and understood, and school children need to be educated about this. I have a great nephew who was bullied at school, a rather innocent boy, and is now happy that he has a loving partner of the same sex, but he suffered. His mother and father are proud of him, but sadly others are ashamed to mention his situation. Norma, I'm talking about 12-year-old children being taught about anal sex. I won't have it. I will not allow it. I will not allow my children to be prematurely exposed to deviant sexual practices. And anal sex is a deviant sexual practice with many dangers attached to it. That's nothing to do with gayness. That's nothing to do with being accepting and embracing of people who are homosexuals, which I have done all of my life. I even got an award from Stonewall for standing up for the rights of gay people to equal treatment under the law long before it became fashionable. Don't try and paint me as a homophobe because I don't want my 12-year-old children to be taught the graphic details of anal sex or other. I don't want to go into some of the other things that they are teaching our children in Scotland. I'm opposed to it, and if I'm elected to the Scottish Parliament, I will seek to scrap it, not because I don't like gay people. There's gay people within touching distance of me now on whom I depend and whom I love. It's nothing to do with homosexuality. It's to do with children. Children need to be protected from premature sexualization. That's my problem with it. Norma says, Martin Howie says, as I posted on the chat, did anyone ever get to the bottom of what happened to Jeffrey Dickens' dossier on paedophiles operating in and around Westminster? Certainly Lord Steele's admission to the independent inquiry into child sex abuse that he failed to pass on allegations against Cyril Smith, the then MP for Rochdale, even though he believed them to be true on the grounds that he believed it to be past history and nothing to do with him, was disturbing. I knew Jeffrey Dickens very well, and I was in Parliament with him when he was campaigning around these issues, and he was ahead of his time. He was saying things that many people thought were conspiracy theories, but now realize that were merely the tip of the iceberg. And to lose his dossier seems a little bit careless, doesn't it? Chris in Colchester will be the last call of the evening. I'm sure it'll be a good one. Go ahead, Chris.
Hi, George. Yeah, I do agree with you. You know, it's with these liberals, I don't like to call them liberals because the dictionary version of liberal is open to other ideas, but they're not open to anything. And
no, they're zealots. They're zealots.
They are zealots, and you know, I can listen, even though I disagree with you about a lot, of stuff, and other people on the left. I can listen to you, but if I turn on BBC News or listen to CNN or someone like James O'Brien, within 5 minutes, I'm swearing at the radio or the TV. I just can't listen to these people. They're maniacs, and it's dangerous.
The BBC, of course, we're forced to pay for it on pain of imprisonment, and yet it doesn't actually reflect popular culture, political opinion, or the national psyche at all. It's like a foreign occupation in the country.
Justin, but with regards to America as well, the liberals in the US, the CNNs of the world and the MSNBCs, they're literally stirring up hatred and violence all the time. And no, where are the fact checkers when it comes to people like these? You know, and when they're cheering on wars, they're nowhere to be seen. And what I do worry about is when Trump wins again, which I suspect he does, if there's a fair election, they're going to lose their minds. And I really do. I'm concerned about what the...
Well, either way, Chris, either way, whatever happens, if Trump wins, if Biden wins, there's going to be trouble coming down the pipe. Well, look, I've literally run out of time. I'm deeply grateful to my friends Through the Glass, who kept a very difficult show on the road. And I hope that you enjoyed it. And if you did, come back next week at the same time, the same place. It's been marvelous.